Good morning, everyone. It is March 17th, 2005, and this is the opening for the House Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. And today we're going to be focusing on a public hearing relating to Senate Bill 5521 on the Board of Medical Examiners. And we would like to welcome Representative Buckley, who's going to be just joining us for the day. So we look forward to having what you have to give to us, Kathleen Haley.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Richardson, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners. With me this morning are Bruce Johnson, he's the Assistant Executive Director, and Carol Brandt, who is our Accounting Manager. The three themes that you will hear in our presentation this morning are a commitment to public safety, accountability, and the wise use of our licensees' dollars. The statement of purpose and statutory authority for the Board of Medical Examiners is that to practice medicine in the state is a privilege, and that the board's primary purpose is to protect the public. You'll find our statute at ORS 677 and our OARs at 847. The board's mission statement follows that statutory authority, and that is to protect the health, safety, and well-being of Oregonians by regulating the practice of medicine in a manner that promotes quality of care. The board is responsible for licensing and regulating physicians, physician assistants, podiatrists, and acupuncturists. We have about 14,000 licensees currently. The board's chief responsibilities are to evaluate applicants for licensure. They do that through a licensure process. About 30% of those applicants do come to attention of one of the board's committees for extra review. We also consider it very much a responsibility of the board to provide information to the licensees and to the public. In addition, the board has a responsibility to let our licensees know about the board's policies, and we try to do that through our website and also through a quarterly newsletter. The board investigates every complaint that comes in the door and takes appropriate action as necessary, and that may include remedial action. That's really the board's first line of defense on problem physicians, is to try to take remedial action, whether it be an evaluation for a quality of care type of case or whether it's an impairment due to substance abuse. In addition, the board does try to rehabilitate folks through our health professionals program, which is a diversion program for chemical substance use.
How much time do you spend dealing with competency issues of physicians?
Chair Richardson, I can get you that figure. That is the large number of complaints that come in the door are related to quality of care and competency issues.
Okay, thank you.
In addition, and not least in importance, is we try to ensure that we have efficient internal operations. I want to tell you a little bit about the board members themselves, and I have to brag a little bit. I think we've been very fortunate in attracting some of the finest, both physicians and public members in the state. We have to have one physician from every congressional district, which has been great because it does give us geographic diversity. We have 7 medical doctors, 2 doctors of osteopathy, and 2 public members. And they really bring a strong commitment to public protection. And I think part of the reason that we are able to attract such great professionals and public members is it's this fascinating mix of law and medicine that they get to deal with on a regular basis. And the other piece of it is the collegiality that develops among the board members. Dr. Thaler's our chair, and he comes to us from Salem, and he's an internal medicine physician. Dr. Grube is our vice chair, and he's from Philomath. He's in family practice. Professor Bald is a retired professor of political science from across the street here at Willamette. Dr. Spokas is a surgeon from Ontario, and he drives once a month, 5 hours each way. Maybe I should say 6, in case anyone's paying attention to the speed limit. 6 hours each way to come over to our investigative committee meeting. And that does not include the hours he spent preparing for that meeting in advance. Dr. Devaney is at the Health Sciences University and is a surgeon. Dr. Johnson is also a surgeon. She's an oncological surgeon in Portland. And Dr. LeClaire is an OBGYN from Eugene. Ms. Smith comes to us from Bend. And Dr. Steiger and Thieringer are osteopathic physicians. They're both in family practice. Dr. Watt is an anesthesiologist. The other piece that I wanted to make you aware of relative to our board members is it's really a commitment to service because, as you know, they do not get paid very well, and they certainly don't get very many kudos in the press. So it's really they're giving back to their communities, and that's what I continually hear from them. Some of their roles are to look at scope of practice issues, the standard of care that needs to be practiced in medicine, to issue those licenses. When I first came to the board, board members used to sit through the meetings and individually sign every single license. We have used automation more to have them sign one set now and put it through the computer. But I was impressed by that, that people thought so much of the license, the board members, that they would sign each one of the 1,000 given out a year, until I saw somebody spill coffee on one of them and realized that we had to do it a different way. They also have that difficult duty of disciplining their peers, and they are not hesitant to do so when appropriate. And they also represent the board before other groups. They're involved in task forces, committees. They go out and talk to their community groups and hospitals about the board and its work. And the way in which the board carries out its scope of responsibilities is through these specialized committee structure that functions very well. We have the 11 members of the board, and then we have advisory committees to the board, and there are about 23 advisory committee members that meet on a quarterly basis. Each one of the committees has a board member that sits in on those committee meetings, except for the emergency medical technicians. And that's because the emergency medical technicians, the board is not responsible for licensing or disciplining them, but instead has sole responsibility for the scope of practice for EMTs and paramedics. Probably the best context for our operating environment is just to look at healthcare in general. And with that, it's just constantly changing. It's changing at such a rapid speed that we have to have a lot of flexibility as a board. The knowledge is increasing every day. We see it in the media, all the new techniques that are available through technology. Telemedicine is an example, something that probably 6 or 7 years ago we wouldn't even have thought of is now a regular part of the practice of medicine. Very sophisticated techniques. And also the online knowledge that not only the physicians have and other licensees, but also the public has access to that and is able to go to his or her doctor and say, what about this? Or also some of the media ads on the purple pill and that sort of thing, and then they go to their physician and say, I want this. And then there's that clash because the patient says, I want Nexium, and the insurance company says, we're not paying for the Nexium. So it's that overlay of the business-driven nature of medicine today that affects our work on a day-to-day basis as well. Part of the way in which we try to satisfy the public's demand for information is to continually update our website to provide more and more information, not only about our licensees, but about the board and the way it functions. We're always trying to think of new things. For example, we have a couple of openings on our Health Professionals Council, and that doesn't come up very often. One way to get the word out is to put it right out on the web right away rather than waiting for our quarterly newsletter, in which case we may miss some applicants.
Mr. Chair, she only has one. Dr. Bates just volunteered for
me. He's kidding.
Happy birthday.
Oh, you found out. This is a bad one, folks. This is a bad one. I don't want to think about this one.
Well, you'll love your 40s.
60 years old. Yeah.
I will say I got carded over the weekend. First time.
AARP?
My son, Central Point, and walk up there and go, and she looks at me and says, if you're over 50, you get a discounted rate. Well, I'm way over 50. She says, let's see the card.
Well, that's better than me. And my second youngest was 17, and they said, oh, is this your granddaughter?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I get so much weird.
Excuse us.
Chair Richardson, I can sympathize because that happened to me, too, in the grocery store. I was not a happy camper either.
This was about 10 years ago. Well, that's the way it is.
In addition to the technology and the business aspects of our of medicine that impact us. There's also, we have a responsibility to the public that we try to have a very friendly relationship with the media, both the local and national media. It's not uncommon for us to get a couple of calls a week, and it could be from the Oregonian or the Register Guard or the Statesman Journal, or it could be from the New York Times wanting to talk about some aspect of medical regulation. I'd like to turn now to the organization and services and emphasize for you that the board is 100% fee-supported. And we have two primary programs. The first is our basic program that includes our licensing, which is the processing and renewal of licensure, rulemaking for all of our licensees, physicians, physician assistants, podiatrists, and acupuncturists, and also our investigations of possible violations of the Medical Practice Act. In addition, we have about 130 licensees around the state on probation, and currently we have one compliance officer, which we will talk about in another portion of our budget presentation, how we want to address that issue. Then we have our technical and support staff, some of whom are with us today, that handle license verifications, the website, accounting, human resources, contracting, purchasing, budgeting, all those types of technical issues. And then the administration that has oversight over all the functions and liaisons with the board and all those 23 committee members that meet regularly in our office. Of course, we're responsible to the governor and other stakeholders, and the stakeholders are numerous in that it's insurance companies, credentialing agencies, other licensing boards, national licensing associations. So we're always having relationships with them, mostly on the telephone, but sometimes in meetings as well. Public relations and education, which, while it's last, it's certainly not in least in importance, because we go out and we talk to the associations. Next week I'm going to talk to the Physician Assistants Association, and in a couple of weeks on a Sunday morning I'm meeting with the Acupuncture Association. And then our second program is our health professionals program. That was set up about 15 years ago as a way to rehabilitate folks with substance use disorders. And they provide for the intervention and the monitoring of those licensees. They do not provide the treatment. Mostly the treatment is in a treatment facility. But they do try to return those licensees to productive practice, and they have a very high success rate, which we will get into in a little bit. We have not had any program changes really in the last 10 years. However, we have had some unfunded mandates, such as registering for the liability cap. We provided a new category of physician licensure, and that is for camp physicians. We were hearing from licensees that physicians from out of state wanted to come in for a couple of weeks and work at a camp, and they needed a license, so we developed a new type of license for them. Malpractice information used to be come to us from the insurance companies. Now that no longer happens, and we are the primary repository for that information. And then there was the issue of pain management, CME, which the board is writing some administrative rules for right now and will be informing our licensees about. At this point, if you don't have any questions, I would like to turn it over to Mr. Johnson to cover our strategic plan.
Any questions on the presentation so far? Please.
Chair Richardson, good morning, members of the committee. It's a privilege to be here and to tell you about our jobs. Guiding our work is our strategic plan. This was originally envisioned in 1999, and it was a joint and cooperative effort between our board members, our managers, and our staff. We update it regularly, and it serves several important functions for us. First, it keeps us focused as a staff, and it sets the direction for the next 2 years. Also, our goals in our strategic plan are linked to our budget, and then those activities that we perform to reach our goals are measured within our performance measurement system. And so we have that fully integrated in our strategic plan. It's a work in progress. The plan is never entirely finished because we're always updating it to meet the needs, the changing needs of our licensees and of the public. And we've included the full strategic plan in the last tab in your presentation binder, and I won't go through it in detail other than to give you this overview, other than it's there for you to look at if and when you have time. You've also asked us to talk about our performance measures this morning and their relationship to our benchmarks. As I mentioned just a while ago, and we do have these in our strategic plan. We've listed all nine of our measures for you on this overhead, and I might mention that all have been approved by the Progress Board. All of our board measures either link to our agency mission or to primary Oregon benchmarks. One of the primary Oregon benchmarks is number 45, premature death or years of life lost before age 70. And we have three measures that directly link to that benchmark, 5, 6, and 7. 5 has to do with the discipline of licensees, particularly in competency of care cases. And I remember earlier, Chair Richardson, you had mentioned wondering what percent of our cases are competency of care. And I just happen to remember that it looks like 47%, almost half of our cases deal with competency of care. That measures that particular issue. Also, measure number 6 has to do with compliance and substance abuse monitoring through our health professionals or diversion program. And measure 7 measures compliance with other board orders of our licensees who are on probation. We think that absent the board's rehabilitative effect in these areas with problematic licensees, that more Oregonians would experience premature death. Now, these measures plus two others directly influence a second Oregon benchmark, number 46, the percentage of adults whose self-perceived health status is very good or excellent. We think that confidence in one's doctor is essential to confidence in one's health. And to enable Oregonians to be sure about their doctors, we provide a website that they can go to, check out the background information on their providers or their physicians, look at their disciplinary history, and so on.
What does that actually reveal to them as far as history?
It's in our Phase 2 presentation, and it's on page 32. Of your presentation binder. If you were to do a license lookup on our one of our board members, this happens to be Dr. David Grube, you would see the following information here, and it's a variety of information that people find useful. It gets their location, business address. It gives their license status, which is important. It gives their license standing down there towards the bottom, which shows unrestricted. If there had been a disciplinary history, it would say prior discipline, and then you would be able to link to that to find out what the problem was. Another piece of information that we've added, and this was pursuant to Senate Bill 786, were the types of languages that our licensees speak that are sufficient for clinical purposes. Dr. Grube happens to speak German. 17% of our licensees speak Spanish. Again, I'm kind of going into phase two here, but I hope I've answered your question.
We have. Let me ask just a kind of a question relating to this whole idea of disclosure and public perception. Have you had discussions about the proposed, I think it's an initiative in Washington State. It's number 336, and it's a 3 strikes and you're out of the practice of medicine. Are you familiar with what I'm discussing?
If I may, Chair Richardson, the board has had some just more off-the-record types of discussion, and it hasn't been a specific agenda item. I do want to make you aware that we also have malpractice information available to the public as well. But with something like 3 strikes, there are certain specialties such as plastic surgery in which it is not uncommon for a physician to be sued multiple times and maybe even have settled as a nuisance suit, so that if in that kind of a case you could eliminate certain specialties, and plastic surgery would be one, obstetrics and gynecology could be another one that would be vulnerable, as is neurology or neurosurgery.
It was, I found it interesting that there was a 68% public approval of this initiative, and so it's like the trial lawyers versus the docs on these issues through the ballot box, and it's not a good way to do legislation.
No.
And I'm glad to see that that Dr. Bates and others are working to resolve in a mutually acceptable manner the malpractice crisis that we're dealing with in this state before you start having these
that kind of
war going back and forth,
thermonuclear weapons using each other, because there's similar things that can be thrown at the trial lawyers. It doesn't take care of the problem either.
Yeah. Well, what they're doing actually is the trial lawyers, and I don't know this, it's just my perception, is that they're responding to the repeated attempts at caps. They're saying, okay,
good there.
Defense is
we'll
a good
go
offense. And so there actually is two bills in Washington. The one that the docs are proposing has less than 50%. It's $1 million cap, public approval. But this other one, which I'd never heard about before, is 68% approval. And it would be bad for the state. It's just bad for the state.
Yeah. I mean, and the public would become very aware of the problem about 5 years after it's passed,
yeah.
When they have no neurosurgeons left.
No, I understand. And so I'm really glad that we are being going to be proactive. We really do need to get this resolved this session.
Right. Because we don't want to end up in an initiative process dealing with it. It's unsuccessful. I hope we'll be successful. That's not the board's purview.
But
you're involved.
The reason I mentioned is I'm actually planting seeds for acceptance of a reasonable solution, because I can see that spreading like wildfire. Mm-hmm. And that, in Oregon, we don't need that.
Yeah.
Please continue.
Thank you.
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, I'll continue. I understand that it is your preference to go ahead and discuss our performance measures in detail, so we'll do that at this time, now that I've just finished the overview. And I'd like to refer you to the handout that you have in front of you, titled Performance Measures, and then also on the overhead we're going to just have the charts up there for you to refer to. And so if you turn to the very first page. It says page 2 here on the bottom.
Can we just ask the committee, as we go through these, if you might be of some benefit or a resource to the committee in asking if these are issues that are performance measures that the legislature needs to be seeing, or are they merely, really more internal audit kind of things or internal measures, and if there's any suggestions on performance measures that would be more useful in the future, we certainly would like to have that as well.
Thank you.
So just one moment, please. Representative Hansen.
Well, just very briefly, though, I would think a lot of these are more of the nature of internal administrative monitoring for you rather than, really reflecting upon the issues that the legislature needs to be reflecting on. One piece of information on that I would like to have, though, is on the license denials upon appeals and the two appeals measures. The number of cases that are involved in that. When you see something consistently at 100%, which is of course excellent, it's nice to know whether the sample is 3 cases or 30.
And I'll be happy to go into that with Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen. I'll go into some detail for you on that. Our first, we have these grouped according to functional areas, so we can kind of make a little better sense of these. I'll be talking about our licensing measures first. The first one is the number of days to process a license application, and this is linked to one of our strategic plan goals of ensuring that we have efficient internal operations. Our target is 45 days, and our most recent data shows approximately 62 days. And while operating efficiency is our goal, rushing licensure and possibly compromising patient safety is not. We do a thorough check of all credentials provided by our applicants to make sure that they meet all the state requirements for providing medical care. Additionally, within this particular measure, there are some factors outside of agency control. We may be stalled from time to time waiting for the applicant to turn in materials or to complete something that was that they had incomplete.
This is one of those things that we don't really know what's reasonable or not, but it would be helpful to know if our adjoining states are doing it in 35 days or 90 days.
Mm-hmm.
So some kind of comparison.
Sure.
I think the national average is around 60 days, if I remember right. And I got to tell you, I'm not sure pushing this down to 45 days, just from my point of view, is necessarily a good thing. Having served on a hospital position where I had to okay physicians coming on board for almost 5 years, there are some questionable things they have to go on. It takes a long time to check out, and you have to be very careful with them. We denied positions from other states who had troublesome records come in. And I think be careful. As I like to say, I'm not sure 45 is a reasonable goal. I think 60 is fine. Take your time. Physicians coming in are planning long-term changes. They don't need to be rushed in for a week or two. This is a long-term change in somebody's life. And I think you using due diligence is excellent. Just from my point of view, I wouldn't worry about this one. If you're at 60 days, that's reasonable. Most physicians expect that. Please be careful. I mean, the number of people I saw applying for licensure at Rogue Valley Province Hospitals who we denied was scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, it's scary. So please be careful.
Chair Richardson and Senator Bates, I'd like to respond to that particular inquiry. We did a survey back in July of 2004. 13 states nationally responded to us, and the average number of days to process licensure for those 13 states was 59 days. So that told us that we weren't out of the norm. And then we also looked at our four surrounding states, and they were in the 60-day range as well. So I think we set we had 1 year where we did quite well, and we probably set the bar a bit low or high, depending on your perspective. That doesn't mean that we're also not going to try to continue to do our licensing in an efficient way. The second measure that we have in licensing is the number of days to process a license renewal. The performance measure here is also directly linked to ensuring efficient internal operations. And this is on page 3 of your handout. We have we had another ambitious target here, 15 days, and we did not meet that in the last renewal period. We renew all of our MD and DO licenses, approximately 13,000 in all, every 2 years. And this results in a three-month period of very high activity for a lot of the board staff, in particular for a unit of three people that does the processing for these renewals. And then we hire some seasonal staff. We find that's a cost-effective way of doing that to assist this group. And during the 2003 renewal, we had two of our three permanent staff members were new, and so they were unfortunately learning their jobs at the same time that the processing was going on, so that caused some delays for us. The bottom line here, however, is that the board by statute must renew everybody's license who is eligible to be renewed by December 31st, and we've never missed that. So, again, there's a target, but we do make our important date. Also, the third...
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Have you... Your license says renew biannually.
That's
and
right.
They all come up at the same time. That's why you have the big push and you do temporary folks and whatnot. Have you just considered going to a 12-month license?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hanna, we did a study, I believe it was 4 years ago. We had a graduate student from Willamette University across the street take a look at that. And given the size of the board and the number of licensees that we have, the conclusion of that report was that it's a fairly efficient way for a board our size to go ahead and renew, again, because we can hire seasonal staff. If we were to spread it out, there'd be a couple of things that would happen. One is we'd probably have to increase our FTE because we'd have a lot of renewals coming in the door every week and every month. So a staff of three people that hasn't changed in 15 years, the number of people, whereas our number of licensees has gone up 45% during that time period. We'd have to, instead of hiring seasonal staff, we'd have to get some permanent staff. Another cost consideration is that we take, because we renew biennially and early in the biennium, we get the bulk of our revenue in the first 6 months of that 24 period. So that money is sitting on deposit over at the state treasury earning interest. That interest is used goes to the general fund. So if you're having money coming in over a 24-month period, you're going to be losing some interest on an ongoing basis. Another thing that we found is that we were going to have a one-time adjustment, because when you shift people from a biennial to a birthday basis, you need to prorate their fees. So there would be, we'd have a one-time loss, I believe it was of about $150,000. And then finally, the last point in this survey was that for our major stakeholders that are involved in this process, not just our licensees, but also our hospitals and our large hospital systems and clinics, it's very convenient for them to send us one check for their 50 docs or their 100 docs. So it's not unusual for us to get a $40,000 check, and they're done with their paperwork for that two-year period. And we did survey them. That was a part of this study. And they said, please don't do this. We'll have to nag our physicians throughout the year to get this in. So after we got that, we just concluded that this would work for us.
Okay.
Our third measure in this area is license denials upheld upon appeal. And this reflects on how well we are doing to make sure our licensees are safe to practice medicine, and it demonstrates if we are appropriately licensing by showing that there haven't been any successful challenges to the board's licensing decisions. And we have met 100% target in that.
And Moss Anderson.
Yes. How many appeals do you have?
Chair Richardson, Senator Anderson, we have not had any appeals during that period. However,
it's a valid statistic, right? You should have zero.
We have had.
Do you have that handy, Carol? Chair Richardson, Senator Moss Anderson, we do have a large appeal going right now for 2005.
You realize what that could do to your statistics?
During the years that we're showing on the overhead here, years 2001 through 2004, we've had anywhere from a low of 20 applications withdrawn to a high of 29 in 2003, and we had 27 withdrawn in 2004. Now, a smaller proportion of those were withdrawn because of derogatory information, and then an even smaller proportion then were withdrawn because of an investigation that was ongoing. So it's more typical, because the board would deny a license only, would take very... May I turn this over?
Sure. Chair Richardson, Senator Moss Anderson, because we carefully review the applications, and then about 30% of those fall out and go to a committee of the board, after that committee reviews them, we do tell the applicant, it looks like you may be denied or you may have a license but with some limitations on it because of the problems that have come to our attention. So what we're finding is that we're having fewer denials, but we're also having more folks withdraw from the application process. Thank you.
I'll move now into our performance measures regarding our investigations department. We have three performance measures here to discuss with you this morning. One is disciplinary actions upheld upon appeal, and this demonstrates if we are appropriately disciplining by showing that there have been no successful challenges to board's decision to impose discipline in the year measured. And we have a high standard here for ourselves as well. It's 100%, and we have been meeting that goal. Another measure is percentage of probationers.
Great question.
Chair Richardson.
Would you help us understand why it is in the best interest of the public and patients to allow a doc who is about to get a bad ruling to withdraw his application rather than have it be on the record that there is a problem that would have resulted in a less than full license? Is that not protecting the docs at the potential expense of the unsuspected patient?
Chair Richardson, most states are going to ask the same kinds of questions, and many times these physicians have licenses in other states. So other states are aware we're not turning over a potential problem to another state, because all that information is available to the other states as well. Okay.
That's begging the question. Question is,
perhaps I don't understand
okay,
it.
The question is it in the best interests of the public to not know that there is reasons why this license is going to be restricted, or is it in the best interest of the public to have the ability for the doctor to merely withdraw that when he because you're giving him a heads up as to what the conclusion is going to be? In other words, is that not protecting the doctor instead of he's filed and here's the result, and as a result of the investigation, whoever wants to know what that result is would have a heads up as to whether or not this doctor is fully qualified or less than fully qualified?
Chair Richardson, I'm still not sure I quite understand it, because the public of Oregon would be protected if that physician was licensed with restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
Or if the physician was denied, which are two options that the board could choose if there were problems in the application. That physician going to another state, that state board will also do due diligence in reviewing the application and can choose to go either route as well. So the public would be aware in either state. And I wasn't trying to beg the question.
Well, that assumes that the other board will have the same information that you have here. For instance, an attorney who is about to be licensed is asked, have you ever had your license revoked, denied or whatever in any other state?
Mm-hmm.
And so if that had taken place, then it would have to be disclosed, which would be a heads up to the next state that's considering this. In this instance, if that happened to a doctor, he could say no, because he got a heads up before it was done that he was going to have a problem, and therefore he withdrew his application.
Chair Richardson, there are national data banks that contain this information as well. The National Practitioner Data Bank is one. The Federation of State Medical Boards has a national database, as well as the American Medical Association. All have databases with this information. In addition, for someone coming into the state of Oregon, we ask for all other licenses. And then if they don't tell us about a license they have in another state where there may be a restriction, we have them query all these data banks before we will issue the license, and we will know about any problems in those other states. In addition, we get a verification with a state seal from the other state that tells us that that licensee or applicant does not have any ongoing problems right now that they're trying to dodge and come to Oregon with.
Right. I understand that.
Okay.
In that same vein, as part of the application in Oregon, do you ask if they've been denied licensure in another state?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen, we do. We do. We have very thorough questions.
So wouldn't it be helpful if you knew that indeed they had been denied in another state rather than had withdrawn their application?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen, yes, it would, but we would still get that information about the withdrawal when we queried that other state.
Of course, where it's going is, shouldn't another state have that same benefit because of what took place due to your thoroughness in Oregon?
Chair Richardson, we would also tell them that when the other state queried us, because the other states do the same kind of reciprocal process.
Except that you give them the option of withdrawing their application because they may have a negative outcome before that negative outcome goes onto the record.
Chair Richardson, that's true. We do give them that option, but we also inform any other state that applicant would be going to.
So you inform other states that the person withdrew their application because there was a likelihood of a negative
outcome? We would say that we would tell them about what the negative information was that we uncovered, and we have the ability to do that under Oregon statute.
And so that would presuppose that they would know to contact Oregon, because since he withdrew the application, there would be no record that he even applied in Oregon. And so, Dr. Bates, not Senator Bates, Dr. Bates, I want to ask you about this.
Yeah.
We're having this discussion. Discussion is that in Oregon, if a doc is applying for a license and is not going to go well, he's not going to get full approval, he gets a heads up on the fact that there may be restrictions and then has the option of withdrawing his application. And so the question is that serving the patients for them not to know that there may have been a problem, because he has the ability to avoid having a cloud on his record because he's getting, he can withdraw his application instead of having to live with the outcome, which is based on the investigation.
I assume he's previously licensed. He or she is previously licensed. They must have a problem from where they're coming from that you've found out. When you find that out, do you share that back with the state he's coming from?
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, they would have had the problem in that prior state. That state's aware of it.
But that's where you get your information from in the first place.
Well, them and maybe the applicant. Hopefully the applicant.
I guess
the only thing I would be...
Here's where it's going. We go back and forth and say, well, they would know or they wouldn't know and all that. The real issue is it appropriate for the Board of Medical Examiners to tell an applicant before there is a conclusion drawn, you know, a result given on an application, that he may have problems with his application and therefore he may want to withdraw that application before he gets bad news? Is that serving the best interests of the public?
My first thoughts on it, I have to think about this a bit, but my first thoughts on, as long as the state that he or she is coming from, if we share that information with them, then I think that's appropriate.
What if it's a new graduate? Turns out he's got a history that he hid, but it got discovered.
I think then that if that applicant applies in the other state, it would be good to have a method of telling the other state what we found out. I don't know if that exists or not, okay? I don't know if we have that or not, but if we do, I hope we do. I'm just trying to think through I'd be more concerned if there was, and this you may do too, I don't know. The applicant comes in, there are questions about that, you're going to limit his license. And you go ahead and grant the license on a limited basis, for whatever reason, and that information be readily shared with the public is what's important. And maybe more than just a web page, but that be readily shared. I mean, we want an informed
public.
That's your
accountability is your second point.
So I'm not sure. I would say the policy of allowing him to withdraw his application is probably okay, but I want to think it through a bit. That's a very fine point to look at.
Chair Richardson, could I respond to your question about the new applicant, because I think that's a very valid one, and that's one that the board, one of the sayings of one of our now deceased board members is we need to tie a can to their tail. And with new applicants, if there is a problem, I've seen the board deny a new graduate, and that's, let me tell you, a very hard day, because you know someone has gone through all the pain and agony and a couple hundred thousand dollars of expense to get to that place, and they didn't belong there in the first place. And that's something we try to work with the schools on, so that those folks are not coming through and coming to the end of the day. But it has happened. I think I can think of at least one time in the time that I've been with the board. So in that kind of a case, there would be no other history. You're right. And then the board has to do it in that kind of a case.
Well, you know, we'll proceed, but I would like to have the board consider the ethics of the current policy, because in a close case, the tie should go to the general public and what's going to be open disclosure to the people. And so if somebody has said, here's my money, I want you to consider me to be licensed here, then would it not be appropriate for the people to have the outcome of your investigation by saying, you know, we're going to give it to you, but only in these regards because of other things, or we're not going to give it to you at all, rather than say, you know what, you don't want to ask us this question because you may not like the answer. It just doesn't smell as, you know, as good as it could. So
Chair,
I'd like to have a concern.
Chair Richardson, I will bring that concern to the full board at its next meeting.
Thank
I assure you.
Chair, I was going to ask a follow-up question.
Senator Bates.
My memory of this is that if you often ask a physician, have you ever had a restriction on your license or your license denied, is one of the common questions we ask. Would this fall under, if a physician was asked, have you ever had a license denied, would that allow that physician to avoid that question by withdrawing the request for a license before a denial is issued? Would that allow them to get around that?
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, I wanted to look at the actual questions themselves. And one of them is, has any state licensing board refused to renew, or denied you a license to practice? In addition, there is a question, have you ever been asked to make a written or verbal response to an investigation or inquiry about your medical practice by this or any other licensing board? So I think those questions do address those concerns.
Would you read the second question again?
It's, have you ever been asked to make a written or verbal response to an investigation or inquiry about you or your medical practice by this or any other licensing board?
Which may or may not be the case. And it was, you know, rather than read those, would you just give us kind of the short answer? It's either yes or no. I mean, is it possible that a person could withdraw their application and thereby avoid having a disclosure that he has been limited or rejected?
Chair Richardson, I think it's always going to be possible because people interpret these questions differently, and that's one of the things that we do hear from our applicants is that they read the question differently than we intend it, and we're always trying to refine them. We're going to refine them again very soon. One other option would be to put the word, have you ever been asked to withdraw, in our questions as well.
Are you saying that you actually would ask them to withdraw?
No. Chair Richardson, I'm saying we could ask them, have you ever been asked to withdraw?
Yes.
Yes.
Are you saying that in Oregon, the Board of Examiners might ask an applicant to withdraw?
No, I'm saying that the Board of Medical Examiners could ask that question on its licensing or renewal.
You would only put it there if there was a chance that the answer might be yes. And so what I'm asking is, could that answer ever be yes in Oregon, that the Board of Examiners might ask a person to withdraw their application?
Chair Richardson, I can't think of any time the board's ever asked someone to withdraw, and I've been there almost 11 years.
Okay, so the real question that you're suggesting would be, have you ever applied for application in another state and withdrew your application?
That's correct, Chair.
That's
major. So, you know, we've kind of gone to enough, but I just hope you see that there's an ethical issue that I would hope that you would address.
I totally understand what you're saying, and we will take it to the board.
Thank you.
Okay.
We have had no
other questions?
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, I'll proceed with our second performance measure in the investigations area, and that's now on, we're on page 6 of your handout, percentage of probationers who reoffend within 3 years. This measure is linked to our strategic plan goal of rehabilitating licensees whenever possible while protecting public safety. Licensees who have received board-issued public orders are monitored by our compliance officer, and then these licensees with such orders are reviewed quarterly by the board to determine their level of compliance with these orders. Our target here is 6%, and we've not been achieving that for the last couple years. This has been a difficult goal for us to achieve. Because of a high caseload, we only have one compliance officer and we have 131 probationers to keep track of. In the same survey that I referenced earlier, we find that this particular caseload in Oregon is the third highest in 15 states. And so we're going to be recommending additional staffing for compliance monitoring, additional half-time position for this, and that's going to be in Policy Package 102, which we'll get into in phase two of our presentation. Our third measure is the number of days to resolve a complaint, going on page 7 now. This is linked to our goal of ensuring efficient internal operations and demonstrates our efficiency in this area. We've set a target for ourselves of 225 days, and we've met that in approximately three of the 6 years measured. During the last 2 years, the board has been able to meet its targets, and this has been because of an increasing number of investigations over the past few years. The board's investigation, the number of people who are working on investigations, really has not kept pace with the increase. We, in our survey that we did, we find that we have the third highest caseload per investigator out of 15 states completing this survey. And we've also requested an additional half-time person to help us with the additional investigative caseload to remedy this. Again, that's going to be in Package 101.
Chair.
Senator Bates.
Do you have any, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any percentage figure of how many licensed physicians that are active in the state that we have on disciplinary action in comparison to other states? Are we about the same as other states? Are we higher? Are we lower? I mean, give me an idea what the universe is here.
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, I can get you the exact number, but I'm thinking we're in the top third in the Federation of State Medical Board survey, and we will get you the exact figure.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
The figure would be helpful because it will tell us if we have a problem bigger than the states do on a percentage basis, but also I'd like to know what drives that. Is our board more aggressive? I mean, some states I know have boards that are not very aggressive, and their numbers may be low because they just aren't looking. And I'd like to know kind of where we stand from the point of view of not only how we compare to the states, but how aggressive our board is in policing our members and helping them to prevent harm to the public. It's not just a matter of a number. It's a matter of what's driving the number, too.
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, I think one of the other pieces is this remedial piece for the board, in that we do ask our licensees to be evaluated as soon as we notice that there's a problem with them, and that could be psychiatric, psychological, competency, impairment due to substance use, any of those areas, and we do ask them, and if they don't agree to go, order them to go to a facility and have those problems addressed. At the same time, with whatever the recommendations are that come from those evaluations, the board imposes on them in an order. So while we may not have as many, say, revocations, that doesn't mean that there aren't disciplinary issues that are being taken care of and addressed.
Thank you. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, again, is back to Measure 7. And I want to read this. It seems like an oxymoron. This goal has been difficult to achieve because of high caseload and only one compliance officer. The very next sentence. In addition, because of small populations of licensees who have board orders. So is there a backlog of these cases? Because it sounds like there's few licensees who have the orders. Do we have a backlog?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hanna, no, we don't. We have 130 licensees on probation around the state. What we require of our compliance officer is that he oftentimes he travels around the state and he goes into the physician's office, meets with them, he may talk with their medical staff. Let's say there's a requirement that the licensee have a chaperone for female examinations. That kind of a case, he'll want to look at the records to make sure that that's happening, to see if there's a notation there. He may also want to meet with the medical assistant who acts as the chaperone to double check to make sure that's happening. And so the backlog really is in that we want to make sure that he's doing his due diligence in covering that number of folks, which is, as you can see, according to the percentages, very high.
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Might we guess that if you had more folks working on compliance that your rate would actually be worse? Because you're not talking about putting training officers out there. I mean, people to help them train or to reduce their recidivism rate, you're talking about really going out to make sure they're doing what they were doing. So I'm just questioning how putting more people out there in terms of compliance, your statement seems to indicate that's going to drive that rate down, but in my mind, the likelihood is it's going to go up.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chair Richardson, Representative Hanna, I guess one of the sort of psychological aspects of that would be that they would know that there were, instead of one person out there taking a look at them, that there are two compliance officers and that they may be seen more frequently than they are now.
Let me, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Bates.
Again, no personal experience here. But I know.
Who knows?
I may change tomorrow. Who knows? But it's the parallel I think is if you've got a speeding problem on I-5, you put a bunch of police out there, they slow down. They start going with the speed limit. And I don't think it's much different than this. Physicians that I've had to supervise, again, going back to my experience at Providence and Rogue, if they didn't know someone was watching them carefully, they had a difficulty in getting there. Okay, for instance, we had a physician who had an alcohol problem. And we told him he would have, whenever he came to the hospital, any time we could ask for blood tests for alcohol. He was supposed to have no alcohol in the system. And when he knew that was going on, he stayed straight. And when we lifted that, we had a problem. And we had to pull his license ultimately. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was watching them makes a difference. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the point you're trying to get to. Mm-hmm.
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, if I may just respond to your earlier question. We pulled it out to find out what our ranking was in terms of the Federation of State Medical Boards, and we were ranked number 15 relative to serious disciplinary actions by state medical boards, and that's out of, looks like, 51 surveyed.
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, we do have a performance measure for our health professionals program, and that's on page 8 of your handout. The percentage of clients who meet the aftercare agreement refers to the licensees who voluntarily enter the health professionals program, usually after an intervention, and who successfully complete the terms of the program, which involves signing an agreement and agreeing to be monitored and to get treatment, and this is for a 5-year period. We have a 90% target for this, and it was met last year.
Again, Mr. Chair,
Senator Monsanto,
what's the raw figure, the number?
There are 110, approximately 110 clients in the program.
Thank you.
And because of that number, the 110, you can notice that some years we've come very close. And when you have a data set of 110 and you have one licensee that either succeeds or fails, that'll move you up into 91% or 89%. So in general, we're pleased with that we've been achieving our goal here. These programs do vary from state to state, and not everybody measures their licensees the same way. But if we were to give you a nationwide statistic in terms of health and diversion programs, most states have an 85% or better success rate. So we're definitely in the ballpark here. The recovery rate of our licensees is considerably higher than that of the general population. They're very motivated. Their license is at stake, and we do track them for 5 years. Now, if they fail the program, they are remanded back to the board for further discipline.
Something that that kind of comes out of the question both of Representative Hanna and Senator Moss Anderson, and that is the information that you present would be more valuable if you had also, an indication of the numbers involved. Because 91% of 101 is different than 91% of 9 or something like that, or 100% of 0. It's just the percentages don't give us as valid an indication as they would if we knew how many people were in the pool. So I'm just saying for the future that'd be useful.
Okay. Thank you for that, and we'll do a better job with that next time. On page 9, we have some performance measures for our technical and support services. We are showing here on this overhead the number of hits on our board website. And that's an indicator kind of performance measure for us, because it tells us that increasing number of hits demonstrates that citizens and licensees are making use of the board's website, and we've consistently exceeded our targets in this area. We just didn't anticipate the popularity and usefulness of the website. And I had really intended to get you an idea of where we rank in terms our website with some of the other state websites in terms of the frequency visited, and I know that would give you some context, and unfortunately the state website was down when I was looking, and so we can try to bring that back for you in the future.
You know, I think that the board has a lot to be proud of in this. I'm not sure how valuable that statistic is to the legislature to know how many hits that you're having. Of course, we're trying to focus on outcome-based, and so if it's the number of licensees who can renew their licenses on the Internet mm-hmm. as compared to having to do it through snail mail, and
mm-hmm.
that's
mm-hmm.
useful because mm-hmm. that goes for efficiency, utilization of your FTEs and so forth, but merely the number of hits, that's probably an internal mm-hmm. issue for you.
Okay. I think closer to what you're... speaking of Chair Richardson, is our next performance measure, which is the percentage of web-generated forms. And we've been exceeding our target here. Forms generated on the website demonstrate that people are able to get the information that they need from the site rather than requesting forms from the agency. So it's been very heartening to know that we've achieved almost 60%, because we put a little watermark on those forms. So when the forms come in the mail, we know, oh, okay, that was generated on the website, and there are fill-in forms. And so it's been nice to get out of the printing and the mailing business, and we're increasingly doing that. So that one's been very useful to track. With the exception of 2003, we've met our targets for this measure, and every time we do have a new form, we try to keep our forms to a minimum. We do put it on the website. The last measure in this area is perhaps in the category of useful to us and maybe not useful to the legislature, but I'll just review it briefly since we have it here in front of you. It's the number of days to pay an invoice, and we have a target of 15 days here, and it's consistently under. And this is an example of not a performance measure approved by the Progress Board, but I just wanted to give you an example that we do have measures of our own to help us, and those are in our management plan. And it's an indication of how well our accounts payable unit is doing. And we changed the target here because we're always below it, but by statute, all state agencies have 30 days to pay an invoice. And so we get the money for services back to our vendors in a quick time, and we're happy about that. We have one last performance measure regarding our administrative area, and if I may, I'm going to turn that back over to our executive director.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Richardson, members of the committee. For the record, this is Kathleen Haley, executive director of the Board of Medical Examiners. And this measure relates to our strategic plan goal of informing our licensees about the board's expectations for healthcare delivery and also to let them know how the board operates. And what happens is that the medical director and I do try to go to the associations, the medical school, visit with the residents, and tell them about the board's expectations and about different areas of medical practice. And then we hand out a survey at the end and ask them whether or not we have achieved that goal. And as you can see, we are exceeding that goal and have been doing so consistently.
You know, that's good information, certainly internally, to know that the people are in... that are attending feel good about what they're getting. Do you have a survey of overall client satisfaction with the way that you function, your interactions with, and the investigations that you perform, the way that licenses are processed? Because those would actually be meaningful as to the success of the board's work.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any such
We don't.
Responses?
Chair Richardson, we have not done a survey of all of our applicants or licensees at this time.
Okay. Overall client satisfaction in every one of the boards and commissions that we're talking about is something that we're bringing up, because that lets us know whether the people that you mm-hmm. are serving are happy with your work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, client satisfaction is really one of the goals we have.
Mm-hmm.
We have a couple more pieces for you, so we're going to go back to the main presentation binder here, and I'll get you a page reference on page 11. and you asked us to give you some information about how we contain costs and stretch licensee dollars. And what one of our main things that we do is we try to automate our processes wherever we can. And just to give you an example of that, it was just a few years ago where we had 7 separate and unlinked databases. So it was not the most efficient situation. If we had an investigator who needed an address, that investigator needed to go down to our licensing area and get that address or wait for the information to be downloaded. And what we've done now is we've linked all of our databases so that they all speak to each other in real time. Everybody has the same information, and most of them are on the same platform. And I mentioned earlier that we continue to make our website work harder, particularly in the area of providing current information to the public. And, of course, this reduces staff time as well and cost, because if you can put FAQs or other information on your website, then people aren't calling you with that. Usually they're looking there first. We've also continued to update our strategic plan. We keep making that work as a management tool for us, and that helps contain costs. And finally, we retool our organizational structure at every opportunity to make sure that it's still responding to the needs of the licensees and the needs of the public, because things change, and we can't just keep doing the same thing or having the same people do the same thing all the time. We've listed some of the things here also on this overhead that we do to avoid duplication. We coordinate our investigations wherever possible with other agencies, particularly other regulatory agencies. We've done some joint and cooperative rulemaking. The one that comes to mind most recent was one that we did with the Health Division in coming up with rules related to disaster planning in the wake of September 11th. We also avoid duplication for the public by triaging calls that come into the board. We have both somebody at our reception area, and we have a complaint resource officer. So if we can't answer that person's complaint, we try to make sure we find somebody in the state who can. That's just a service we like to provide.
Henson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the coordination of investigations with other agencies, if you suspect or are made aware through one of your investigations that a law violation has occurred, sexual misconduct, illegal drug applications, whatever, do you mandatorily report that to law enforcement?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen, we do, to the district attorney of that county.
Great, thank you.
One of the other things we're doing to minimize costs and avoid duplication is to work with the Health Division and the Oregon Medical Association on a statewide patient safety initiative. One of our current initiatives internally is an organizational and process review of our licensed services department. We've brought somebody in to see from an objective third-party viewpoint if there can't be some work simplification or if we could change some of our policies and procedures to improve some of our performance measures in that department. You've also asked us on the next overhead to give you some information on how we've prioritized our programs within the agency, and also to talk about cuts a little bit, 10% cuts. We have just by statute 2 programs, both operations and diversion, and we've ranked them 1 and 2. Operations has our core licensing and investigations function, and diversion, as we've mentioned earlier, provides intervention and monitoring of licensees with substance abuse disorders. Both of these programs are mandated by the state. And I'll tell you about the criteria that we used. Our first criteria was to make sure that our activities were fulfilling a statutory requirement. Second, we wanted to look and make sure that the activity was fulfilling or working towards or influencing an Oregon benchmark. And then our third was to make sure that the activities served the most Oregonians. And once we went through that process, that's how we came up with this particular ranking. Moving into cuts, which is also at a summary level presented here for you, the bulk of our reductions would come from cutting staff if we were required to do that. Almost 70% of our budget is personal services dollars, so it's hard to talk about or think about making cuts without looking at staff. And we're listing four positions here, one each in licensing, in investigation, support services, and diversion. And if I were to generalize, I would say that these positions are more customer service-related positions. So let's say we took out the licensing position. The effect would be that we would slow down the amount of time that it takes to license new applicants. And this would have less of an effect on public safety and perhaps more of an effect on an applicant's pocketbook, because it would take them longer to get into the workforce. If we removed our complaint resource officer at the board, again, we'd have a slowing of our services, because it would take longer to do an investigation. Right now, somebody calls the board, and they're put in touch with that complaint resource officer. So absent that position, that call is going to come in and get directed to one of our investigators who's working on somebody else's prior complaint. They're going to set that aside, answer that question, and so on. So that just gets to be kind of a snowball effect in terms of slowing investigations, and that's one of the performance measures we wanted to improve. So if, again, just trying to give you a general sense here that we'd be slowing our services. Our cuts in supplies and services have the same theme, and that is we're going to try to keep our public safety intact, but we would slow down our services somewhat, and it would probably have a negative impact on our performance measures. That's what we have for you here today. It's the end of our overview, unless there are any questions.
Questions for this phase one presentation? Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We didn't discuss any of the license renewal around medical folks who come from foreign countries.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us briefly how that works? How do you do accreditation both of the individual physician and or the school they attended?
Mm-hmm. Chair Richardson, Representative Hannah, I probably will be able to do a better job of that at our second phase, but off the top of my head, the requirements are a little bit different in that there are 3 years of postgraduate training required for a graduate of a foreign medical school, and it has to be United States residency training. So there are some differences. There's also a group, and I hate to use acronyms, but I can't remember probably all the words for this, but it's called ECFMG, Educational. I can't even, you know, pretend to know exactly right what that is. ECFMG is a body that does review those foreign applicants for United States licensure, and we require that of our foreign medical graduates as well. So we have a series of different steps we're able to take to ensure that. We also have another rule that requires that they have to have attended in-house, in the building, in the medical school, so many months of didactic training. So I will have for you at the next, if not before, if you'd like it, some of the very real requirements that we have for these foreign medical graduates. So I'll be able to provide that for you.
Are there also foreign doctors that have temporary visas to certain arrangement that so many doctors can come to the state? And are we fully utilizing that?
Chair Richardson, we've been working with the Health Sciences University, where the bulk of those physicians go, and we try to work with them around the timing of the licensure and so on, because I think sometimes that they get caught potentially in a catch-22 if we don't issue the license soon enough. So we've been trying to work with them on that, and I think we have successfully.
Okay. Representative Henson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A lot of your workload is generated by complaints. Now, are all of those external complaints that come from outside your agency, or do you internally generate any of those complaints?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen, it's both. You're right, the bulk do come from the outside. However, the board does review all malpractice closed cases, whether by settlement or by court, jury verdict.
and reviews those, and those get reviewed by our medical director. We have a physician on staff who reviews every case. And those are then forwarded on to a committee of the board that meets on a monthly basis for review. So the malpractice are come to us, and so they are an internal type of case. And then also, say the board's investigating Dr. X and learns that really the problem was with Dr. A, then the board would open a case on Dr. A and begin that investigation. Okay. So those are the two more internal.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the concerns I have for Oregon is that most people are not aware that many of us feel there's going to be a looming doctor shortage in the state in the next 3 to 5 years, maybe sooner than that. We're seeing a large number of physicians retire earlier than we'd expect in their 50s. We see an increasing number of physicians who only work part-time. It's a lifestyle choice for many of them. There's a lot of job sharing going on. And we're concerned that we may actually run into a situation where we have a significant shortage. Is the board trying to look at that and follow that at all? Is it something that's under your your concern, or is it something that just we follow as far as this one's concerned? That's somebody else's responsibility.
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, no, I think it's a very real concern because all of our members have to have an active practice in order to serve on the board. So they come from all over the state, so they are definitely aware of these issues and are of concern to them. So they try to do due diligence in their licensing and discipline and at the same time recognize that we may have this problem there.
Thank you. I was looking at the graph that deals with licensure, and it indicates that there is a fairly steady increase in the number of licenses being issued. And so how real of a problem is it?
Well, Chair Richardson, I think that the big increase is coming from three areas, actually. Physician assistants, we're seeing more physician assistants licensed, more acupuncturists. They're the largest, I think, growing group that we're seeing in the state. And both of those groups have now two schools each in Oregon, which is a relatively recent development. And then the limited licenses for some of our Oregon Health Sciences University folks, those are the increases that we're seeing rather than the physician increases.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions, comments, thoughts? Not, we stand adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.